So the last 2 weeks, we talked about the problems in this modern world, how even though science has made things very comfortable for us, but we are comfortably unhappy. In the olden days, we were uncomfortably unhappy. Now we are. That's the only difference. In fact, unhappiness, I think, has increased as material progress has increased our desires, our demands. I must have this, I must have that. So the level of dissatisfaction is very high, even though we have achieved so much. And I'm not belittling science. Science has given us so much, but has, in that mad pursuit for worldly objects, we have lost track of our inner self. What is the goal of life? And what am I truly seeking? We are all seeking happiness, but we are seeking in the wrong place. And our rishis thousands of years ago had discovered this inner joy. And the path for that, they say, is meditation. So the topic today is meditation and life. It's on page number 13. I won't be referring too much to that. So you don't really need to read it, because the chapter doesn't have too much information. What I'm going to do is take a little turn away from that chapter, because the chapter has basically two or three major ideas. And after that, we'll branch out a little bit into the different schools of philosophy in Hinduism, and how they all of them, the basis of all of them is meditation. They all lead us to that. So though there are very different schools over few thousand years before Christ, these schools came into being. So I'll talk about that. So basically, we, as we had talked before, science has taken us to the basis of human existence, and that is atoms, where they say everything is atoms. You know, we are all made of atoms, this table, this book, this mic, everything is made of atoms, and we are all atomic particles combined in different, you know, shapes and forms to make a chair and make a human, make a man, woman, all that. But we are all basically atoms. And then atom was also split further. And first of all, they thought atom is ultimate. And then atom was split further. And then they came into the energy part. That atom is nothing but energy, protons, electrons, and neutrons. So protons and neutrons are in the nucleus and electrons spinning. And that is the basis of matter. So energy. So it came down to energy. And so everything was positioned towards that. And science, as we said, has helped us to make the outer world. So their search for fulfillment was in the outer world, how we can make the surroundings better for all of us. And so for humans, they did that and made it very comfortable and very peaceful and very, you know, where we can pretty much get what we want. We can go where we want. We can do what we want. But the masters of old, the philosophers, they concentrated on the inner world rather than the world of objects. The science mainly works in the world of body, perception, objects. They worked in the realm of the mind and the intellect, and taking us inward to our vasanas, our tendencies, and ultimately inward to God's presence, which here is indicated by Om. So that was the field of the philosophers. And they concentrated on the mind, because they said if the mind is happy, the person is happy. If the mind is agitated, if the mind is disturbed, then a person is disturbed. But if the mind is peaceful, the mind is stable, such a person. An unhappy mind, even living in the best of circumstances, you know, living in a $1 million home with all the comforts, can be unhappy, while a person whose mind is peaceful, even if he's sleeping on the street, he could be happy. So what they showed us, that the happiness is not so much dependent on objects. Yeah, we need some amount of objects to be comfortable. I'm not putting that down. But ultimately, if we are searching for happiness, we have to work in the field of mind and intellect, emotions and thoughts, and take that inward, take that deeper. And they found the path of meditation, or discovered it, or heard, you know, heard it in their own meditation, and they gave that path to us, which they call as dhyana. Which then dhyana, when it went, was taken by the Buddhists, you know, because Buddha, of course, his teachings were based on Hinduism. His branch of teaching was an offshoot of Hinduism. From Buddhism, that dhyana became Zen. So the word Zen has its basis also in dhyana, which means meditation. Now, the Hindu philosophers over the few thousand years before Christ came up with six schools of philosophy. So I thought today we would talk about the six schools of philosophy, which are pretty much very widespread and cover the whole spectrum of the philosophical thinking. So it's interesting for me also. There are some things I learned when I was researching this topic. So basically, they say there are six schools of philosophy. The Sanskrit words you don't need to worry about. That's not important, but I just listed them. So one is the Samkhya. Samkhyan philosophy comes from Sankhya. Sankhya means counting. So the Samkhyan philosophy is very logical. A goes to B, B goes to C, 1, 2, 3, 4. So systematically, they take us to the path of spirituality. And in fact, the Bhagavad Gita, which some of you are familiar with, which is our the basic text, the Bible, is also based on the Samkhyan philosophy. The philosophy is Samkhyan, but the teachings of Bhagavad Gita are Advaita, the highest. So that is the first philosophy, where it logically takes you. And they talk about two aspects, spirit and matter. That this whole universe is composed of matter and spirit. Matter is inert, you know, which makes up, say, the table and the chair, and even our human body is basically inert. But it is the touch of consciousness called Om or spirit, which innervates us and makes us alive, makes us function. So we are actually, and that's why when this consciousness is no longer functioning through our mind and intellect, and such a person is said to be dead. And so the matter is there, the body is there, the eyes are there, the brain is there, and the person looks for all purposes alive, but we all know that once the consciousness is no longer functioning through that individual, then that person we need to either bury or cremate, because his body is useless. So spirit and matter, and the goal of life in them is to reach the spirit. What they say, reach the spiritual essence within you, disregarding the role of matter. Matter is important in that. They're both equally important, but they also tell us to go to the spirit. Then the yoga, some of you have done yoga, you know, have learned yoga, and the yoga is based on Patanjali, was a great teacher, and he had eight limbs of yoga in his Patanjali Mahayoga Sutras. Eight limbs, and some of you, those who have attended yoga classes, may have heard about it, but in those eight limbs, he talks about control of the mind and body, living a divine life, then practicing yoga, which are the physical exercises, then pranayama, which is the breathing, that's the four limbs. Then fifth is withdraw from worldly attachments, attach to the higher, the Lord, meditate, and then merge, disappear. Where the individual becomes one with that. Does not mean his body ends, but his whole being gets pervaded with that. And so the individuality ends and God alone functions through him. And that's why people like Jesus could say, the Father in heaven and I are one. So that is the yoga of Patanjali, the eight limbs. And the final goal is meditation and then merger, becoming one, called samadhi. The third is nyaya. This is the systematic method of knowing. They say to know anything, whether it's mathematics, science, spirituality, religion, philosophy, there are six methods of knowing. One is perception. Like I can directly see. I can see him sitting. I can see the chair. That is direct perception. Or you can hear the sound, me speaking. So that is the direct perception. Second is inference. Inference means far in the mountains, I see smoke. So I say, where there is smoke, there must be a fire. There's probably a fire in the mountains because of which I am seeing smoke. So that is inference. Where there is, I haven't seen the fire, but when there is smoke, there is fire. The third one is comparison. Comparison means now, say I have seen a palace in here, or say I've seen the White House. And somebody says, how is the president's house in India? Somebody says, I visited. How is it? So you say, okay, compared to the White House here, you've seen it? Yes. It is this size, it is this appearance, you know, this lawns, gardens. So what I have seen, and you compare it with that, and so that is the third way of knowing called knowledge, comparison. The fourth one is logic. Logic is, you see a lady who's with you all day and she's not eating anything, just barely touching food and drinking water and, you know, coffee and hardly eating. She says, I'm on a diet. You know, you say, okay, but then she still is gaining weight. So you say she's not eating anything but during the day, but still gaining weight. So what does that mean? She's eating at night. So logic, you know, logically you can prove that even though I don't see her eating, if she's gaining weight, then there should be a reason. Then the absence. Absence means a person is absent. So from that you figure out maybe that, like say Diana is not here today. So we want to figure out where is she, what happened, why is she. So an absence of something, or absence of, like there is an absence of heat, it is called cold. Absence of light is called darkness. But the sixth one is the most important, and that is testimony. Testimony means information we have got from the scriptures and information from the spiritual masters. And to know God, testimony is the only way. You cannot know God by perception. You cannot see him. You cannot know God by inference. You know, I have seen God somewhere and now I'm, no, you can't, you know, nothing like that. You cannot compare it with anybody. God is like, no, God is not like anything. Anything that we know of cannot be equal to God. Logically, you cannot reach God through your intellect. Absence, you know, God can never be absent. So not by absence, only by verbal testimony, by reading the Bible, the Gita, or by listening to teachings of great masters, you can reach God. So that is the Nyaya. The fourth one is called Vaisheshika, which is the atoms, which actually is interesting. Several hundred years before Christ, about 2000 years before Christ, they already knew that everything is made of atoms, which, you know, we discovered in the 20th century. You know, that the world is made of atoms. They already had, they called it Anu. Anu means atoms. And they even talked about subatomic particles, smaller than Anu. So they already knew that in those stages, without microscope, without science. And they said that this whole universe is made of atoms. I'm not making this up. You can, you know, research it in the literature. And then they said that there is a consciousness, which they call Brahman, which they call God, which they call consciousness, which, when it illumines the atoms, when it gives life to the atoms, that creates life. So the world is inert, made of atoms, and it is consciousness that causes. So they actually talked about atoms and consciousness several thousand years ago. The fifth one, called the Purva Vimamsa, believed in the Vedic rituals. Vedas are our essential, our four books, just as the Bible is, you know, for the Christians, or the Quran is for Muslims. Vedas consist of four volumes. They're not actually volumes. They are multiple volumes in four different sections. Four Vedas, four different sections. And each one consists of several volumes. And the Vedas are divided into three sections. So the Vedas are divided into the three sections. The first two deal with, first one deals with nature, praise of nature, because they see God everywhere. So this was the original teachings, you know, about 6 to 8,000 years before Christ. The original Vedic master sat in the forest or under the banks of the river, on the banks of the river, and meditated. And so they saw nature, because nature was plentiful at that time. There was not much construction, no cities, just few people here and there. So they live primarily in nature, And so they saw the beauty of nature and the mountains and the all that. And so that's how they composed hymns in praise of nature. And it is said that these Vedas were not written by a human, but when they went into deep meditation, they heard these words when they were in meditation from the cosmos. So that's why they are called Shruti, heard. They are not written by anybody. But when they heard that, then they passed it on to their disciples, and then the disciple passed it on. So it was the cosmic sounds from which they got these mantras, the Vedic mantras. So the Vedas are divided into three sections. One is the nature, praise of nature. Second is rituals, Vedic rituals. Rituals mean, you know, as you might have seen, they light a fire and offer things to the fire and chant mantras to reach particular gods. So these particular group of masters stuck at the Vedic rituals. The rituals are all important. You just keep doing the rituals and you remember God and you dedicate everything to God. And by doing rituals, by doing prayers to God, you will reach the highest. So they did not go into the knowledge portion. See, the Vedas have three portions. One is the praise of nature. Second is rituals. And they got stuck at the rituals. Rituals are an important part of religion. Like when you go to the temple, there is a way to pray. When you go to the church, there is a way to, you kneel down and you light a candle and you chant some hymns, you know. So each religion, like in the Islam, they, you know, bow down and, you know, five times a day face Mecca and pray. So each religion has its rituals, but rituals are not the final. Rituals are a means to reach the final. But a lot of religions and religious people get stuck on rituals. The ritual alone is important, my way or highway. If you don't practice my way of worship, I'm going to destroy your temple, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to convert you. So rituals are the means to reach knowledge, but are not the final. But these people got stuck on rituals. And the sixth one, which is what we practice here in this building, throughout the Chinmaya mission, throughout the world, Chinmaya mission has 300 such branches, and where the same knowledge is taught by Swami Chinmayananda, who was the founder of our mission. So there they talk about oneness, that there is only one God. You can call him by different names. You can call him Allah or Father in Heaven or Buddha or Shankara or Krishna. You can worship him in different buildings, through different books, with different techniques, different methods, but originally that God is one. And in here they call it Brahman, means the big one, the big, which is all pervading. So all names of God lead to that one. All books lead to that one. All religious masters talk about that one. So the Advaita talks about the oneness, unity, that first of all, there is only one religion, there is only one God, and there are different ways to worship, and they are all okay. It's not that this is the only way. Whatever path you choose, wherever you are interested, it is fine. They don't have any problem. They're not trying to convert. They're trying to say that all paths are good, number one. Number two, they talk about oneness. Oneness means God and I are one. God and I are not separate. And we grow up with that idea that God is, that I and God are separate. So God is where? He's in the temple or church or mosque, or he's somewhere in heaven, or he's in somewhere in, you know, above the clouds, above. So, you know, we, as children, we grow up with that. And that is reinforced by our scripture. If you do this, God will be angry with you. If you do this, God will be happy. So we have this idea that God is some supernatural power sitting somewhere, watching over me and judging me and punishing me and all that. What the Vedanta preaches is that God is not somewhere separate, but God is within us as life, as consciousness, constantly speaking through us, listening through us, functioning through us. Here we have indicated as Om, but you can put here Jesus, you can put Allah, you can put Father in Heaven. So God is And the good or bad that is happening to me are the result of my own karmas. The law of karma is the action. that it is because of my own actions that good or bad, if I'm something good is happening, I must have done something good. Either in this life or in previous lives, we do believe in multiple lives, reincarnation. And if something is bad is happening, then I must have done something bad. And we see that here also, you know, it's very clear. If you drive at 75 miles an hour, you're bound to get a ticket sooner or later. If you drive within the law, you are not. We tell even our children, if you study well, you know, you'll do good in school. You'll get a good, you know, go into a good college. You have a good career. If you don't study, you'll end up, you know, as a bum on drugs. So the law of karma, we explain to our children very clearly. So same way it applies to each and every one of us. So God is not, because God is everywhere. That's what we say. God is everywhere. He is in heaven. He is in the church and temple. He is in the clouds. He is everywhere. He's in the mountains, the rivers. Everything are that manifestation. But we all are also. So God is within us. So God is everywhere. There is nowhere, no place where he's not. Like people say, where is God? Can you see God? Our masters say, where is he not? Where do you not see him? You know, everything is God. One of our great teachers, Raman Maharishi in the 20th century, he was asked by his student, he says, can you show me God? He said, yeah, I can show you God. He says, okay, go ahead. So he moved his finger. So he said you will show me God. He said, yeah. I don't see God. He said, this piece of flesh, how is it moving? That is God. Why do you don't, you know, we always have this image of God will be this powerful light that will. God is with us constantly, watching over us, taking care of us, protecting us, loving us. God is a very loving, compassionate, kind presence in our life. All we have to do is realize God's presence as love, as compassion. And when you see love in somebody else, somebody's very loving, very kind, that is God. Very compassionate. You see a great achievement, a great scientist, you know, astronomers, now they are, you know, finding out things that were billions of light years away from the Big Bang. That is God, that brilliant scientist. That is God, a beautiful piece of music. You hear somebody playing beautiful classical music. You see somebody composing poetry, a beautiful book like Shakespeare. That is God. You see God in such creativity, an artist painting, everything is God. All we have to do is open our eyes. So God is not far away. That's what they're saying. God is with us and realize his presence. And how do we reach him? Through meditation. So all of these, their final purpose is meditation. And that's why this book is called Meditation and Life, that if you want to improve your life, meditation is the best way. And then the last one, this I won't go much into detail, these first six, all of them believe in divine presence, that there is some divinity. You can call it God, you can call it spirit, you can call it whatever, atoms, consciousness, but there is a God. Now these charvakas, this is the materialistic, and to some extent we are all living in that age where they said materialism alone matters. Who cares where is God or no God? How does it matter? You are here, right? And why did you come? By accident. What happened? Your mother and father met, and so you appeared on this earth. Where you came from? Forget that. There's nothing. You just appeared. And where are you going after death? Nothing. There is nothing after death. You are dead. You are dead. You are alive. You were born because of an accident. Your mother and father, you're living now. And after a few years, you'll be dead. Dead, you'll be buried or cremated. How does it matter? Afterlife, heaven and hell. So whatever 60 or 70 years you are here, enjoy life. Eat, drink, do all your pleasures, any sense pleasures, whatever you want to enjoy. There is no restriction. There is nothing about this one wife and one husband. Just enjoy life. Why are you wasting your time thinking about God and meditating and praying and go to church and all? Go to a bar and drink. You know, that is true joy. And enjoy, earn money. You know, they say earn a lot of money. Why? So you can enjoy more. Become very rich. So you can be very successful. You can enjoy whatever. So this is, to some extent, I think we are living in this Charvaka age, where people think that alone is important. You know, earning, enjoying, drinking, drugs, you know, unfortunately. So these are the major schools of thought, and they all told us that meditation is the final path to reach that spirit, the consciousness within us. So that's why this meditation class will try to show us the inner spirit, inner consciousness, and the oneness between God and me. So God is not separate, but God is in all of us. God is not only in me, but in her and him and her is everywhere. So that is. So this is the major schools of philosophy. I thought I would talk a little bit about that, and the fact that philosophy takes us inward and science takes us outward. So both are necessary. Outer progress is necessary, but we have neglected the inner progress, and that is why there is so many problems. So for truly to be free of problems, we have to pay attention to both science and philosophy. Both are important. So I'll end here. Any questions, any comments, anything of any of these particular schools? If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. Yes.
Well, I'm early in the process, but it seems like to me that the Hindu religion is the best, would be the best religion for the whole world. And I say that because it says, you know, we respect all religions because we believe they all worship the same one God we worship.
Right.
Christianity and Islam are much more aggressive. And I just wonder, why Hinduism is not as evangelical? It doesn't promote itself
right
the way the others do.
They never did. From the beginning, even the rishis, you know, thousands of years ago, when they sat on the banks of the river Ganges and they meditated, they never went and told people, come and learn from me. They never did. They sat there and meditated. They said, if anybody is interested in learning, he'll come. And so people came, you know, people who were in search of wisdom. And they used to say, I need to know more than what the world can give me. You know, in fact, there is a line which says, Pariksha Lokan, you know, having seen and accomplished everything in the world, the person was still unhappy. So what they said, what should I do? Guru me vabhi gachet. So such a person should find a guru. Guru will not come and speak to you and tell you, come and listen to me. I am here to teach you. No, he's just sitting there. He says, you want to learn? You come find me. And so such a student will go asking around, you know, I'm looking for a guru. And he will go find that guru and he will sit down and ask him, guru, you know, teach me this knowledge. And the guru will first test him to make sure he's sincere. He's not wasting his time. And when he sees that the student is sincere and is deserving, then the guru will teach him. And then that student will become a guru and will teach others. So the idea was to pass on the knowledge from guru to teacher, guru to teacher. And they never believed in pushing their ideas or prop. In fact, most of the Upanishads, the Advaita, the Vedas, doesn't even have an author's name. They didn't even write their name. All the Upanishads you have, some of the beautiful Upanishads in the office, very beautiful texts with profound knowledge. And you read it there, you don't even know who the teacher was, who the author was. They never even bothered to promote their name. They said, this knowledge, we're going to give it to the world. They had no patent. They had no copyright. They even didn't put their name. Even they didn't even want the fame or glory. But what I am seeing and what we are seeing, that slowly these ideas are spreading on their own. Nobody is trying to evangelically promote it, but like yoga, all over the world it is spread, right? Nobody, aggressively, meditation. People all over the world are meditating. Where did that come from? There's nobody said on TV. Now, some places, you know, people like in India and some places, people are teaching meditation on TV and all, but there is no aggressive promotion. slowly this knowledge is spreading. This knowledge of oneness is becoming all over the world. People are realizing there is one God, and conflicts on religion are not right. Even though there are a group of fanatics and fundamentalists who are still sticking to the old ideas, but it's not going to be around for too long. There will be, of course, always violence and conflicts. But the wise people will slowly understand that the path to peace is through oneness. If you say my religion is better than yours, and if you don't follow my religion, I'll kill you, that's not going to get you anywhere. So ultimately, the wise people are understanding, and slowly these ideas are propagating. And I believe that in the next 50 or 70 or 100 years, it will become a worldwide phenomenon. It is already becoming, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedas, Upanishads. People, more and more people are reading it. So I think it will happen. But, you know, he knows. He has his own mysterious way of working. But that's the only logical way. See, the only logical way to create peace in the world is by oneness. As long as the oneness is not there, there will be always conflict. Yeah, sorry, did you want to say something else?
Well, I looked it up, and on Google, according to Google, the largest religion in the world is Christianity with about 2 billion,
mm-hmm.
and then comes Islam at around 1 billion, and then just below that was Hindu,
right.
And below that was, just below that was Buddhism.
Buddhist.
But the thing is like, Hindu was the first religion.
Yes.
I mean, it predates anything and
right.
everything. And the only other religion I know is Christianity. Man, there is a lot of stuff in Christianity that was originally in
yes.
the Hindu religion 5,000 years before. Meaning, it looks like to me, these are, the younger religions are just variations
of the origin.
The first.
Right.
And it's a shame, because I think a lot of people go through life without the benefit of a religion,
right.
a faith, because, you know, they just cannot find the truth in Christianity or
right.
Islam, where it's either convert and believe like me or I'll kill you, or convert and believe like me, you're going to go to hell.
Right.
You know,
I think that is because people have not understood the teachings of the original prophets. Christ never said that. Christ never said that. Christ preached love and tolerance and compassion and love thy neighbor as thyself and all those things. It is subsequently the religions were used for political power, and that's where, you know, the power became. And even in Hinduism, we have, you know, people who use religion to make money or to become powerful. It's not, you know, Vedanta is not universally practiced in India. India still has a lot of small sects and rituals. And there are people who will misuse religion and say, come to me and I'll teach you. And in return, give me the money, you know, or give me power. Or they use political power, religion to win votes or influence people. Because India is a very religious country. So they will use religion to get elected, you know, caste and all that. So it is there all over. But the original teachings, if you go to, all masters preach love. All masters preach compassion. Look at Buddha. Look at everybody. But it was the misinterpretation by subsequent followers that is the cause of all the problems. And the world will always have problems. World, even at the time of Jesus, they had problems. Even the time of Krishna or Ram, when God appeared on earth, there were conflicts, there were wars. There were problems. It always has been there. It's just magnified because of the internet. We think it is worse, but it has always been there. Good and bad was always there.
But in today's world,
yeah,
it seems like religion is as much a cause of violence and
yes,
you know, death as anything else.
Exactly.
But we have subdued science. I mean, medicine. Things, dentistry, but religion now, which is, you know, it seems to be politically
right.
motivated, is the one that's driving all the
yes,
pain.
I agree. Religion should be a source of love and peace. It is becoming a source of violence. I totally agree with you, but it is misusing the religious principles, and that is the problem. So actually, there is a very nice story about this. Maybe next week I'll tell you. We don't have time today, but I'll tell you the story about, you know, you focus so much on the negativities. So I'll tell you the story next week if we have time. I'll make it a point, so please remind me. But you're right. It is a misuse of religion and religious ideas that has created all the... I 100% agree with you, but that's how it is. We can't change the world. We can only change ourselves and make ourselves peaceful, make ourselves happy, and become an instrument of change in my community, in my surroundings. Let me make where I am a better place. That's all I can do. You know, we can't change, you know, like Jesus could change millions, Buddha could change billions, you know, millions and millions, billions. But you and I cannot do that. We can at least change a few people. Change ourselves and then change the surroundings. That's all we can do. And that's all he expects of us. He says, you know, rest, leave it to him. I just do what I can. That's our should be our philosophy.
Can you say about oneness?
Yes.
The oneness and stuff, but there's two aspects of God in Hinduism. If I heard it here, only here, there's Brahman and Brahma. So Brahman is the God here that takes care of the physical, and then there's Brahma, the higher.
No, actually, it's the other way around. Brahman is the formless. It is the support or substratum of the whole universe. The whole universe came from Brahman. That's the total consciousness. But Brahma is the creator. So a job of creation was given to this entity called Brahma, which the universe was created. But it is that same consciousness functioning through this world called Maya, which creates the world. That is called Brahma. So they are not separate. It is that one Brahman, when he takes the role of creator, he becomes Brahma. Then when he sustains the world, he becomes Vishnu. When he destroys and takes us away, it becomes Shiva. So three aspects, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the creator, the sustainer, and destroyer, which are all actually one. But they play different roles, like a lady at home, say she's a wife and a mother. But then when she goes to work, she becomes an executive. She's a manager in her company. Then after work, she goes to a club where she's doing social service. So she's a president of, say, Rotary Club. So now she's the president of a community club. And then after that, she goes swimming or goes to play tennis. So she becomes a tennis player. So that same lady who was a mother and a wife then becomes an executive in her company, then becomes president of Rotary Club. Then she becomes a swimmer or becomes a tennis player. It's the same lady. So you say, oh, is she a mother or is she a tennis player or is she an executive? Here it's the same. It's the one person playing different roles at different times. So similarly, that one consciousness plays different roles. So we think they are different. The same lady, you see her in tennis clothes. She looks so different. Then you see her in a suit, business suit at a conference. And then you see her at home in her, just a slacks and a, you know, casual shirt. It's the same person looking different. Completely. So same way, there is no difference. There is no duality. There is one appearing as many, playing different roles. That is what it is. There is no two in the actual Vedantic teaching. But people have misunderstood it and made it many. And they say, my God is... So they worship one aspect of God and they say, my God is bigger than your God. And there used to be violence. Like people who worship Shiva would kill people who worship Vishnu. Things like that, unfortunately. That's all misunderstanding of the oneness. Brahman is the total and Brahma is the creator. So when he takes the role of creator, he becomes Brahma. But there is no difference between them.
So Brahman, that would be like Maya then? Is that...
No, Brahman is the support. Maya is the creative power of the Lord. And Brahman uses Maya. And that time he becomes Brahma. When he creates the world through the power of Maya, that is called Brahma. So Maya is not the ultimate. Maya is the creative power with which he created the universe.
You know, in physics, there's two kinds of energy.
Right.
You know, the potential energy and
the kinetic
energy. And,
right.
You know, Brahma, you know, would be potential.
Brahman, energy. Yeah. Brahman. Yeah, the N,
and
yeah.
Brahma would be kinetic.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. That's exactly. Potential energy, which does not do anything. Brahman doesn't do anything. But then it becomes kinetic energy, 100%. That's exactly right. Thank you. That's a very good analogy. Is that clear? Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Okay. If you can just turn off the middle and the left switch. The middle and the left. Just press those. The bottom. Yeah. Thank you. So we ran about 5 minutes over with questions. So maybe we'll go 5 minutes over in our meditation if everybody is okay with that. Today we'll focus on the inner energy, the inner life principle, the consciousness. Eyes closed. I sit with the attitude of a seeker. I am neither man nor woman. If it's noisy, you can close the door, please. You can hear the sounds from the hall. I am neither man nor woman, neither young nor old. I am neither a businessman, lawyer, engineer, doctor, housewife. I am a seeker of truth. For the next 20 minutes, I have no attachments. No other desires. I'm only seeking the truth. I sit with that attitude. Back is erect but not stiff. Consciously relax the body from head to toe. Start from the head, focus on the face, the neck, shoulders, and so on. And relax each part of the body. When you reach the feet, then you move back slowly up to the head, completely relax each part of the body. turn your attention to the breath. Slow deep breaths in and out. Slow deep breaths. Full attention on the breath and nothing else. Attention on the breath and nothing else. Slow, deep breaths. When thoughts arise, understand. Thoughts arise in me, from me. I am the consciousness. And the thoughts are an expression of that consciousness. If the thoughts arise in me, from me, I should be able to regulate them and channel them. The mind and thoughts should not take over my life. Direct your mind and thoughts to the consciousness within, the life principle. The source of all peace and joy and bliss. That consciousness I am. Let us pay attention to that consciousness. When thoughts wander, bring them back by observing the breath. And direct your conscious, your mind inward to the inner life principle. Let us practice that for a few minutes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.